So the story continues, and so after my children were born, I stopped working just about a month before my son was born, and then we were living up in the country and in Sonoma County, and it was a lonely time for me. My parents were in Chile. And all my friends from the Asia Foundation were working in San Francisco, and I was at home with these two little kids. And so reading was really important for me. So I had a friend who gave me a book on Jung to read, Introduction to Jung. And and also I read things like William James' varieties of religious experience and Freud's interpretation of dreams, and then Maslow's Toward a Psychology of Being. That book was really important to me. But the main turning point in my life, probably the biggest transition of all, and was the beginning of my more explicit spiritual path, came in 1965, when I was 30. And I had earlier signed up for a child psychology course, correspondence from Berkeley, because I had two little kids and I didn't know anything about children. I'd never been around children before. So, poor things. Anyway, we don't get a lot of parental training in this culture at all. And so there I was. And so I took this course, and then I got this flyer in the mail from UC about a conference that was happening in Asilomar on psychotherapy, mysticism, and psychedelic drugs. This was 65, 1965. And so my husband was an architect, and he was interested in creativity and trying different things. And so off we went to this conference at Asilomar. And that's where I met Houston Smith, who became a teacher and mentor of mine for the rest of my life. Actually, Houston was the person who married me with my second husband. And so he's been a very dear friend all these years. And so 65, and I also met people like Willis Harmon, who was first president of IONS and so forth, and people who became lifelong friends. Also, most importantly for me, as in terms of being a messenger, was Jim Fadiman. He was a psychology graduate student at Stanford at the time. And he suggested to my husband and me that we might be interested in going to Esalen sometime. So we did. And the first time we went to Esalen, we used to listen to Alan Watts on the radio before that, in the early 60s. And then Alan Watts was having a dialogue with Bishop James Pike at Esalen. And so we thought that would be intriguing, and so we went, and it was. It was a lot of fun. I think it was a small group of people. Esalen was just getting started then. And then we went again to Esalen, signed up for a seminar in humanistic psychology. And there were eight people plus Esalen staff, Mike Murphy and others, Anyway, it was led by Anthony Sudich and Miles Vick, who at the time were editing the Journal of Humanistic Psychology. And then that was in 65, and they started the field of transpersonal psychology a few years later. But for me, that was really significant because it I thought this was something that I was really interested in. Instead of psychology as I had it at Stanford, which was all about measurement, prediction, and control of behavior, here was something that was really addressing values, meaning, and purpose in life, and talking about the whole person and talking about human potentiality, human growth, and that we grow and change, and you don't have to be sick to get better. You know, it's not all about pathology. It's about growth and change, and your experience matters, you know. So that was very inspiring to me. Well, then I thought, yes, this is really very, very appealing, very interesting. Well, it was there at that seminar, I think, where Jim Vandeman showed up again and said, you know, he was working on this research project at the Foundation for Advanced Studies in Menlo Park with Willis Harmon and some other people. And they were conducting a study on psychedelics and creativity. And that caught my husband's attention because he had been reading about these things, and so would we be interested in being subjects in that study? And my husband said yes, and so I thought I'd come along. And we had to go for interviews with the psychiatrist who was running from the program, and they said, well, you know, if one of you does it and the other one doesn't, it's quite likely that you might end up getting divorced because it can change your worldview. Of course, at that time, people were getting divorced anyway, 50%, I think. But they didn't mention that. So anyway, we both went through. We went through the program, and it was very well done. It was very, very well run. And so we had this experience of being given a very heavy dose of LSD, and I think it was mescaline combination, and it was a very profound mystical experience for me. And it's not true that everyone has the same kind of experience, you know, it varies a lot. But for me, it really opened up the whole inner universe, and it was as though it's totally ineffable. You can't really speak about it. But I came away thinking that all I could say was that God is love and the truth will set you free. Well, you know, that's something I'd heard before, but I didn't really know it until after that very deep experience. And so that was fine. And then, of course, there was the... shortly afterwards, about 6 months later, they shut down the research studies because it was made illegal. Well, however, then you know, then came the fun part of, you know, Fillmore and dancing and so forth, and Richard Baker, who was later the Zen. The abbot of Zen Center, organized a conference in San Francisco where Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert and Michael Harner and all the people who became famous later were talking. So, of course, we went to that. So it was very interesting how alive that whole movement was at that time. And it was before things had kind of gone downhill, you know. It was a very exciting time. And it was a time of a lot of idealism and, you know, everything was going to be wonderful if we could just change consciousness and if everybody would wake up and feel more connected and so forth. And anyway, it was certainly a turning point in my life, and that combined with Esalen, I signed up for a psychology class in humanistic psychology, worked away eventually on a master's, and people would ask me, what are you going to do with a master's degree? I said, I don't know. I really didn't have any plan, but I knew that I wanted to do it. And it was such fun, and it was so interesting, and I had such a good time. And the education was so different, because instead of reading and then talking about it, which I love to do, nobody wanted to read anything. Everybody was only talking about their experience. And so this was an eye-opener for me. I'd never occurred to me that anybody would ask me about my experience, you know. And so this was a totally different dimension of education for me. And so as soon as my youngest child started nursery school, I signed up for one class, and then two, and then three. And so it took a few years, but I did get my master's. This was in my 30s. And then finally, by the time I was 39, I had completed my PhD. So at 40, it was another turning point. But during that decade of my 30s, I started doing spiritual practice of various kinds, Zen meditation first, and then the Eureka training with Claudia Naranjo and Eslin Wilschitz and encounter groups and Fritz Perls. And oh, I have a nice an anecdote that just came to mind about Fritz Perls. When Fritz Perls was dying, he was in the hospital, and he was all in, you know, had intubations and stuff. And so all of a sudden, he sat up and started pulling these things out. And the nurse said, oh, no, Dr. Perls, you must lie down. And he said, nobody tells Fritz Perls what to do. And he died. I love that story. So anyway, during those years, after I got a master's, I got a job in the counseling center at Sonoma State College, and then I started doing a lot of dream work groups, because I really enjoyed dream work, and I had taken some classes from some wonderful Jungian teachers, and so I was just really thoroughly, I had found my calling. I really felt I had found my calling. And so at the same time, again, Jim Fadiman came along. As soon as I had completed my PhD, he came along and asked me if I would like to become an assistant or associate editor of the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology. And that was around 73, I think. And I said, yes, because I've never done any editing in my life before. But I've learned that if somebody asks you to do something and you don't know if you can, but you're willing to try, you might as well. It sometimes can work. So I learned a lot about editing. I learned a lot about the field of transpersonal psychology, and I learned some discernment about what you could accept for publication and what you couldn't, and what people were writing. And so that was a great experience. And so by that time, I think we had moved to, yes, we had at the same time, and we moved from Sonoma down to Tiburon, and so I've been living in the same house for the last 44 years. And my husband, let's see, I'm going to get this sequence here. Both my parents died when I was about that time, and they had moved to Southern California, so I did have the privilege of being with each of them when they died, which was really important for me. In that time, it was like another transition into maturity, you might say, when you suddenly realize you're the older generation, and there isn't anybody in between. I think that one of the issues that come up for people is that in searching for spiritual teachers, they often are looking for a substitute parent, and they want somebody to kind of mediate the awesome nature of the universe and reality, and also tell them, to help them make decisions and tell them what to do. There's my friend and colleague who passed away recently, Arthur Dyckman, wrote this wonderful book, The Wrong Way Home. And he had this image. He said, people are longing for that time in childhood when they felt totally taken care of. And they might be driving home after an outing and lying in the back seat of the car, just knowing that their parents were in charge and they didn't have to worry about a thing. And that somehow we're longing for that in our lives, just to be taken care of. So my attraction to freedom was very helpful to me in many ways, because I did an awful lot of, I had a lot of teachers who were, just gave me enormous opportunities for learning, but I never did become a true believer in any one system. I have much gratitude for my Zen teacher. I first started sitting with Suzuki Roshi. Went to Sasahara for a dialogue between Suzuki Roshi and Houston Smith, and this was, during that decade of my 30s, and with Claudio Naranjo. My husband and I were in his group in Berkeley, of course, Claudio was Chilean, and I could never transfer onto him like some people could, because I was in school with his first wife. And so somehow it didn't really click for me. But years later, Roger, my husband, we were at a conference in Europe with Claudio, and we were sitting around the lunch table, I think, with other presenters and at a transpersonal conference. And somebody said, oh, Claudio, do you know Francis? And he said, oh, yes, I was responsible for her breaking up her first marriage. And I said, I don't think you can take either the credit or the blame. And fortunately, my husband, Roger, piped up and said, well, it turned out rather well. So those were some of the little bits of the history. And I was very, I'm grateful for all those adventures, what I call my hippie period, and also grateful that my children were almost like my parents, because I was very responsible. And so wasn't about to stay out all night. I was going to go home. I was going to make sure that, they were taken care of. And so then another major, major turning point, when I was 40, I got divorced. And that was hard. We'd been separated for about a year or so, but my divorce was completed in 75, when I turned 40. And by that time, I did have my PhD and my license. So I started to start up a private practice. So after I got divorced, my parents had all passed away, so I couldn't go home to mother, so I took my children to visit my older sister, who was living in London. By that time, I was doing workshops, because I had published my first book, Awakening Intuition, and that came about because I knew I had to do something. I was going to have to support myself. I had to pay the mortgage. I got to keep the house, but I had to pay the mortgage, let alone save for college and so forth. So I went to the UC Extension and said, I proposed to do an extension course in Awakening Intuition. So they looked at the outline and said, okay, fine. So I started doing that, and then people liked it, so then all the other extension offices around the state had me do it for them. And then all the growth centers started asking for it. So by the time I got divorced, 1975, I was off doing, I took my kids along and we did a workshop on the East Coast, and then we went, we're going to go and do another workshop in Holland, and they came along with me. They were 13 and 15 at the time, and I went to my first international transpersonal conference in Iceland while my children stayed with my sister in London. And so that was just the beginning of a whole new era for me, because the other piece that fits in around that time was that when I was working in the counseling center at Sonoma State, I heard about this conference on altered states of consciousness that the Menninger Clinic was putting on. Once a year they had these conferences, and I thought, that sounds like something I'd like to go to. And so my yoga teacher at that time, who was on the faculty there, said, well, I could probably get you an invitation to come to Stanley Krippner's doing this, and, you know, he'll probably invite you to come. Well, he did. He said, I was still in graduate school. And, or maybe I was, I guess I was almost completed my PhD yet. Well, I remember, I hadn't even started the PhD program, because I remember asking for leave from the counseling center. I'm like, man, it was director of the counseling center. She said, you think you know enough to go and be at that conference with all those important researchers? And I said, I don't know, but they invited me. And I thought, if he can have a PhD, anybody can have a PhD. Maybe I could get a PhD. And never know where your inspiration is going to come from. So I did. I went to the first one, and it was 1971, so that a lot of things started in that decade, and by the time I was 40, and I had my PhD, and I had been to some of these conferences and met all kinds of people that were just kindred spirits that became good friends. It was as though I really felt I belonged in the field of transpersonal psychology, and I was, we were a small group, but we were riding a wave. It was the beginning of trying to integrate spirituality with psychological growth, and that was really what our calling was, in a sense. How do we really bring this into people's lives in such a way that we're not discarding spirituality? And in those days, you weren't allowed to say spiritual, anything spiritual, to any self-respecting psychologist. So it was how to bridge that gap, how to start it out. So it was a very exciting time. And then Stan Grof showed up. I met Stan at the Menninger conference, and Stan started, when he moved out to California, he was working in the East Coast first. He was a psychiatrist from Czechoslovakia who had come over in 1967 to work at the Johns Hopkins doing LSD research. And then after he defected, and he didn't go back because Czechoslovakia at that time was behind the Iron Curtain. And then he moved out to Esalen soon after that, and then he did a lot of month-long programs there where he invited us to be faculty members down there visiting for his month-long program. So I sometimes say that with my relationship with Esalen was the first 10 years I attended workshops, the next 10 years I led workshops and taught down there, and then the 10 years after that I would go to occasional invitational conferences. All these things sort of worked out in different decades. And so after getting divorced, I really had to pay attention to earning a living and being a single parent and taking responsibility for all that. So I feel very fortunate that I was able to make a go of it and had opportunities to teach. I taught for almost 10 years at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology down in Palo Alto from 75 to for about 10 years to 85, and served on as president of the association. Jim Fadiman had been president of the association before me, and so I didn't know what I had to do as president, but I learned. And I remember like being asked to teach because somebody hadn't shown up for a personality course, and I'd never taken a class in personality theory, but they asked me if I would take the course. Well, yes, I will, you know. So I stayed up till midnight trying to figure out what I had to do, and I got a great education on personality theory. I say, you teach what you want to learn, you know. So there were a lot of wonderful sort of things that happened serendipitously, and I think that that's when I felt very clear that, you know, the winds of grace are always blowing, but you do have to raise the sail. And I was working hard to raise the sail. And, you know, I don't know if I would have had the same kind of discipline if I hadn't had the responsibility for those two kids, you know, because my former husband decided to drop out, and he bought himself a sailboat and went off to the South Seas for the next 4 or 5 years. And so there I was, really having to do both. That was that sense of responsibility, as well as the sense of this wonderful opening up and learning about, because I sometimes say that initial psychedelic experience was like, it really opened me up so deeply, and then it was like my intellect wanted to catch up with my experience. And there was no field of psychology that was big enough. I mean, I really liked Jungian psychology, but there was still, it was too small a container for me. It was more than what was addressed there. And also in terms of the relationship to the unconscious, and I really appreciated psychosynthesis and the working with the higher unconscious as well as what they call the lower unconscious. And so psychology was just such a perfect fit for me at that time. But I was always interested in transformations of consciousness, and that's still true. So I just feel there were so many things that occurred that were not part of my plan. A divorce was not part of my plan. And so anyway, I liked those conferences at Mentor so much that I went back three or four times, I guess. And the last time I went was in 1976. So there was starting another decade and starting my 40s. And in that decade, in 1976, I met Roger Walsh there at that conference. And Tom reminded me just earlier, he said, when the way Roger tells the story was that he had been kind of depressed at the conference and hadn't talked much to anybody. These were conferences that went on for 5 days and were 100 people, and we all would eat together and have all these, you know, breakout groups. Well, I met Roger. I had met him, but just hardly spoken. And Roger, I have to tell it as if he were telling a story. He said, on the last day of the conference, I finally got up and said something. And in the back of the room, this woman stood up and said, I totally disagree. So that was me. And it got his attention. You know? And he had come over from Australia on a Fulbright and was doing a postdoc at Stanford. He was a psychiatrist, a neuroscientist. Didn't have any interest in anything spiritual or any transpersonal, never heard of it, you know. Kind of, he was a hard-nosed neuroscientist. I thought, oh, well, he's... I mean, what does he know? I don't want to have to agree with him. But anyway, when we got back to the Bay Area, he did call, and we had dinner together. And I thought he was pretty interesting. I certainly had a good mind. And so anyway, he persevered, I would say. And we did get to know each other more. And I know, you know how I had asked the universe for someone to show up in my life that could match me on the physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual plane. Well, he didn't look like a candidate at all. So anyway, that was 37 years ago, and now we've been married for 28 years. So even though I never thought it would last, it lasted. So I was very skeptical about it at first, but it just seemed to have, it seemed to just keep on going, because he started doing meditation retreats about the year time we met, and I had done some, but then we both started doing Vipassana with Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein and so forth, and and Roger just went so deeply into it. He would do 3-month retreats, and I fortunately was never drawn to doing a 3-month retreat. So I would do a retreat a year, you know, for many, many years. Appreciate. I still sit every day, but I keep remembering with great affection my Zen teacher, having done. I did a year of precept studies with her, and then took lay initiation into that tradition. And I remember the one thing she used to say: "In silence, we learn what can never be taught." And that has been a real gift. In silence, we learn what can never be taught. So I often think of her words still, but the gift of teachers like that I've encountered has been, I do think that ultimately life is our teacher, and that we have inner teachers and outer teachers, and sometimes people who are the most challenging to us are our teachers. I try to remember that when I'm trying to work with somebody that is difficult. And my clients are my teachers. My children have been my teachers. And I just feel so much gratitude for all the teachers that I have that have crossed my path. I should probably say that it was in 1971 at Council Grove, Kansas, that the Menninger Conference, that I first met Pir Vilayat Khan. And then later, much later, I guess about 10 years later, I met Atum, I think in Cambridge, wasn't it? You came to interview me when I was doing a program, Pir Vilayat was interested in psychology and spirituality, and so. And then Atum, I still remember that was a good meeting. I'm glad you our paths crossed there. And then some years later, I fell in love with Lex Hickson's book, Coming Home: The Experience of Enlightenment. Lex Hickson, Coming Home: The Experience of Enlightenment in the Sacred Traditions, and he became a Sufi sheikh, and so he came out to visit us, and he initiated both Roger and me in at a zikr in San Francisco, gave us our names and so forth, and And then he died not too much later. Unfortunately, he died when he was quite young. Of course, the older I get, the more I think people are young, if they're younger than I am. They say the people that you think are old are the ones who are at least 15 years older than you are. So, but I just have so much gratitude for so many people who have somehow come into my life and then become friends. And all my relationships, all my friends and colleagues and people I've had the opportunity to work with over the years, I just feel that's been such a blessing, because, and of course, and Roger is also my teacher, because I think when we have any time you have an intimate relationship, as we like to say, remind each other, it gives us lots of opportunities to practice forgiveness. And it was also in that decade of my 40s that I, in 1975, that same year, just after I got divorced, I was introduced to the Course in Miracles, and it turned out that I was living there in Tiburon, where I still live, and it turned out that one of the scribes, Bill Thetford, of the Course, took early retirement and came out to live in Tiburon. And I thought, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And I had first met him because he and I were both on a panel for the Congress of Orthopsychiatry, talking about new ways of healing or something like that. And I was talking about transpersonal psychology, and he talked about he was not yet retired. He was head of the psychology department at the Columbia University. College of Physicians and Surgeons, and he spoke about his relationship with his colleague Helen Schuckman, who was having these psychic experiences, and then she took this in her dictation, and they would meet in his office early in the morning, and he would type up her notes on this dictation that she was getting. And she had thought that she might be going crazy, because she was an atheist Jew, and here came all this Christian stuff coming through her. And he was, in his good Rogerian fashion, was reassuring to her and said, well, why don't you just take notes and we'll see what it says. Well, he had been an agnostic and not interested particularly in anything psychic or spiritual, but the more it poured through her, the more interested he became, and so he started studying all the world traditions, and he said, you know, this is sort of like the Christian Vedanta. And he was a wonderful friend and a wonderful teacher for me for the 12 years that he lived in Tiburon after he retired. He was a mentor because he had the background in psychology, so he could be a consultant for me for things that I was struggling with in my practice. And also, at the same time, he had been studying this material for many years, and it had clearly had a very powerful influence on him. And so, so I started studying it too, and then when Roger saw it, he wouldn't have anything to do with it because he wasn't interested. And he saw the word God or something in there, and that was not for him. So, but then he got to know Bill and a few other people who were working with the Course at the time. And so he thought, well, these are smart people. There must be something to it. So he started, and he was a convert. You know, he was worse than I was. just like his immersion in meditation, you know, and whatever it is, he really goes for it. So that's been very useful for us to have that material to work with, and we've learned a lot about forgiveness from it, because basically what the message is that if you that forgiveness is the means of opening your awareness to the presence of love in your life. That as long as you are holding on to fear, grief, and fear and resentment and anger, that you can't really open your heart to experiencing the love that is available. And so it has been very useful as a practice to recognize that forgiveness is a means of awakening to love. And to realize that forgiveness is always about the past, and that we have to be willing to let go of the past. That forgiveness, in a way, translates of letting go. Letting go both of resentment and anger, but also letting go of our own guilt about what we did or didn't do in the past. So if you do let go of the past, then you're free to live more fully and wholeheartedly in the present. And that's the gift of being able to really live more fully in this present moment. As it says, this instant is the only time there is. All of the future and all of the past live only in the mind. This is where we live, here now, in this moment. And this moment is the only time we can experience love. So it's about opening the heart and recognizing the gifts we've been given. And so that's been a very valuable teaching. And one of the things I always liked about Bill Thetford, he didn't want to be set up as a guru or a teacher or anything. But people would come to him and want him to interpret, you know, the Course says this or the Course says that. And he said, well, if you can't agree on what it says, just tear the page out. So he was a very good teacher for me.